Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to talk about how the plant that stops antibiotic-resistant bacteria that could save hundreds of thousands of lives, and how, if you want to get a plant-based omega-3 fatty acid, you should. I'll tell you what it'll do based upon a study from Stanford University School of Medicine. Also today, University of Würzburg in Germany, a Mediterranean diet can lower your risk of a particular condition in women. I'll explain that. And how iodine-rich foods, and I'll tell you which ones are rich in iodine, fights breast cancer, and much more on health and healing. But the majority of my program today will be a series of commentaries. Commentaries from Professor Henry Giroux from Truth Out, Anti-Politics and the Plague of Disorientation, Welcome to the Age of Trump. Plus, I have written two important commentaries based upon the history of the abolitionist movement and the disinformation campaign now occurring within the corporate democratic movement, and how, where is our sense of history? We're being had. Also, I want to take you into one example, just one, of how bad Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton are for America. And I'm not going to talk about America. I'm going to talk about Haiti. Two audio clips from Haiti, because I have a lot of listeners. I try to do a lot of work to help the Haitian people. In fact, I was up in Harlem, the only person from the media and the only person from any alternative media to demonstrate in front of the Clinton office against what he did with the money. But it didn't get to Haiti, didn't help any of the people in Haiti. So we're going to talk about that. Also, I'll tell you the facts behind the truth in Libya. The New York Times won't tell you. In fact, none of the mainstream media has the courage to go into Libya and say, what was the truth before we bombed it? Did we need to? Was it a threat? I'll give you that story. And remember, that's just one. I could give you the story behind Russia. Russia's not a threat. NATO is. I could give you the story of the different states that are run by oligarchs or fascists and how we support them. Why? So we have a lot of very serious issues to discuss, and we will today. But we always begin by empowering people with positive choices with their diet and lifestyle. This is from the University of Würzburg in Germany. They state that eating a Mediterranean diet, which is vegetables, quote, high in fruits, vegetables, nuts, legumes, and whole grains, had a 20% lower risk of hip fractures in women than those who did not have that diet. And this is a very important study. By the way, there are over 1,000 studies now on the power of the Mediterranean diet. And this one was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. So the takeaway message is when you increase nuts, seeds, fresh fruits, and vegetables, and legumes, beans, into your diet, you're going to have better mineralization and therefore less osteoporosis, less hip fracture. One thing we don't get enough of is iodine. And women with iodine deficiencies, which are most, are more likely to develop breast cancer. So here's the takeaway message. When you eat more of the iodine-rich foods, you lessen your risk of breast cancer. And if you, well, at least where I came from in West Virginia, almost all the women I knew, my mother included, had that scar on their neck because they had goiter. And the goiter was associated with the low thyroid activity, which was associated with low iodine activity. And that swelling, which is painful, of the thyroid is called goiter. But iodine also plays a crucial role in women's breast health. In fact, a lot of studies show that the more iodine in the diet, the lower the risk of the cancer the breast. Where do you get them? Well, cranberries, potatoes, including the skin, navy beans, those are your vegan sources. But you also have salmon and cod are good sources if you are going to be choosing to have them from the ocean. So that's important. Also, we have a situation now where people go into a hospital. They're in there having some procedure done, and lo and behold, they look down and on their arm or their leg, they have this infection. And that infection can go really bad and goes into the blood, and I mean in a real fast time, a day, half a day, 2 days, they're dead. Now, the hospital will do what it can. It will start giving as much antibiotics as possible into that person's system. Trouble is, most of these, like the MRSA, they're pretty much antibiotic resistant. So that should tell us that most people entering hospital have defective immune systems. You would think that they would put energy in strengthening the immune system. The stronger your immune system, the more likely you are to survive any condition. So antibiotic resistance is now an epidemic worldwide. And what we're seeing, we've been taking too many antibiotics into our system. We get them in our food. We're given penicillin and methicillin. Now, these were miracle drugs at one time, and they saved lives. But when you start using them all the time, then gradually your body develops this ability to use these antibiotics, and it ends up destroying the gut bacteria that you want. And then when you're faced with a MRSA, which is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, or MTR-TB, which is a multi-drug-resistant mycobacterium tuberculosis, or CRE, which is a carbapenem-resistant enterobacteria, these are all going to become extremely virulent superbugs, and Western medicine has no defense. So, and it's not just here in America, it's everywhere where you have a lot of antibiotics used in animal feed, and over 50% of all our antibiotics are fed to animals. Why? Because it allows them to gain weight faster. And if you gain weight faster, you make more profit. So what is one of the solutions? Well, there's one plant that can really defeat them. Now, there are a combination of plants, like if you were to use olive leaf extract, 1,000, 2,000 milligrams, and wild oregano oil, and colloidal silver, and peppermint oil, you could also make an enormous challenge to it. But there's one that has a direct impact, and that is cannabis. Now, you see, we've been on this whole campaign from the 1930s through the 1960s. Why? Because cannabis was bad? No, it was used. It was used and we benefited as a society because clothing, fuel, pharmaceuticals, timber, all of that at one time was substantially from the plant from which cannabis is grown. And we said no to it, not because it was bad, but because hemp was considered a threat to other industries. Now we know that the cannabidiol, which is one of 100 different cannabinoids, is responsible for helping kill off these bacteria. It also is very strongly anti-carcinogenic, neuroprotective, antipsychotic, and anti-inflammatory. And the science is there. So there are five principal cannabinoids. There is the most powerful one, probably, and the most commonly used in research one is the cannabidiol, D-I-O-L, at the end. And then the cannabibiochromia. And so these all show strong methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus strains can be killed. So the takeaway message is this. as a backup to everything else you do in life, like a health insurance, having a home natural pharmacy, a little travel kit that you can take with you in case you get infected with something in your travels. You should also have the name and phone number of a physician who is experienced in and has no problem giving you a prescription for a cannabinoid. A, if you have breast cancer or lung cancer, that's a definite. But also, if you ever should be in a hospital where someone you know is, and they have an infection, and they're dying because there's no antibiotic that will treat it, give that doctor a call, and they'll get you this, and the doctors in the hospital can use this, and it can kill it and save lives. And from Stanford University School of Medicine, the plant-based omega-3s can lower your risk of heart attacks, deaths. Quote, eating both seafood and plant-based omega-3s could mean a lower risk of dying from heart attack, a meta-analysis found. And this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. It looked at 45,637 participants in 19 separate trials from 16 separate countries. And here's what they found. By taking in those omega-3 fatty acids each day, you could reduce your risk of dying from a heart attack by 25%. Wow, that's tremendous. Quote, these new results, including many studies which previously had not reported their findings, provide the most comprehensive picture to date of how the omega-3s may influence heart disease, end quote. And that was from a doctor at the Cardiovascular Research Center at Stanford University School of Medicine. So get your omega-3s in. How much? I would suggest 1,500 milligrams twice a day. And finally, people have argued, well, organic is more expensive, therefore I'm not going to eat it. How do you know? Did you go to the farmer's market and check to see their prices, food co-ops? And also, which organic are you talking about? Are you talking about a pound of organic potatoes? It's under a dollar. Now compare that to a pound of processed potato chips. That's $16. You're getting a pound of potatoes, one processed in trans fats, salt, chemicals, and creating cancer-causing acrylamides in the body. The other, alpha-lipoic acid, the organic potatoes, natural amounts of calcium, magnesium, amino acids, it's really good for you, even vitamin C. So it's how you buy, knowing how to purchase makes a difference. But then on the science itself, a new study shows, and this was 150 separate scientific studies, and they compared organic versus non-organic. And 25 scientists published the findings in the British Journal of Nutrition. Here's what they came away with. Quote, they found that the organic 56%, and when it came to the omega-3 fatty acids, more and in the organic. So you're getting more of the, and you're not getting the harmful pesticides or the GMOs. You're getting more antioxidants. So clearly, going organic makes a big difference when it comes to your health. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health. We're going to take a break, come right back, get into some heady commentaries.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream, with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad.
Well, that's Can You Spare a Dime? Something from the 1930s. I'm sure many of you have watched the different conventions and some of the talk shows where all you see through MSNBC and the New York Times and all the mainstream media and CNN is support for Hillary Clinton. She is pro-women. She's pro-labor unions. She is pro-environment. She is pro-peace. She is pro the common worker. She's going to stand up to Wall Street. You've heard the notions, and then the people at the convention. But there's another Hillary Clinton, as there is another Democratic Party, as there is a different story. And I'm concerned that we understand the consequences of voting, as Noam Chomsky, as you will hear, wants you to vote for Hillary Clinton. And others, who I will not mention because they're on Pacifica stations, but popular, with small audience, but popular. And they want you to vote for Hillary Clinton. And they also are the ones who denigrated Ralph Nader and wanted you to vote for John Kerry. Boy, that would have been a wise choice. So just remember, as long as you vote for either Trump or Clinton, you're voting for a neoliberal corporate agenda. If you vote liberal, you're voting today for a neoliberal corporate agenda, no matter how they want to wrap it. And that brings me to this. And I want to thank Professor Henry Giroux for his unique insights, because unfortunately, and I think most of the listeners know this, the United States, the whole world, is getting precariously close to going over the edge into that abyss of authoritarianism. We're just a tiny bit away. It is my belief that we need to understand the context, historical, cultural, political, and economic, which has created this moment in U.S. society in which fascism becomes an endpoint. People actually strive for it. They applaud it. How many times did you see them when Leon Panetta and other clearly highly fascistic sounding people were getting standing ovations for saying what? We'll be tough on the enemy. We will give more money to the military-industrial complex when you haven't even accounted for the money that has been missing, trillions of dollars, misspent through corruption, cronyism, redundancy, where 10 different corporations get the same amount of money for the same single contract when not even one was necessary, where there are graveyards out in Arizona that are thousands of acres filled with hundreds of billions of dollars in military equipment that some legislator got appropriations for and lobbyists made sure it got through, that we never used or did and was of no value. Even Bernie Sanders and his C-35, $1.5 trillion, the most expensive outlay in the history of the Defense Department for a plane that doesn't fly, yet never brought up. So it is in this context that you look at Trump or Clinton, not only symptomatic of the problem, but also understanding that there's going to be more to come. Because when you support by your vote the lesser of two evils, you do not have a platform for changing the evil. And put it this way, yes, you can call Hillary Clinton the underside of the new neoliberal oligarchy, which indulges some progressive issues, tiny ones of no significance, but is indebted ideologically and politically and financially to the criminogenic culture of finance, racism, and war. Put differently, Hillary Clinton represents a less obscene, less in your face form of authoritarianism, but that's hardly a viable alternative to Trump. It is my personal belief that Trump will not get any better no matter how he's coached, because I believe he stopped growing emotionally and intellectually at 14, because that's how he presents himself. Maybe this is all understandable in a corporate-controlled neoliberal society that uses new communication technologies that erase history by producing a notion of time wedded to a culture of immediacy. Today, young people care about speed, now. They want endless flows of fragmented, useless information. That's their basis of a so-called knowledge forum. It is vacuous. Our universities, including the so-called elite universities, are pumping out an entirely functionally, historically, culturally, spiritually, emotionally illiterate graduate. And we don't think that's unusual. It was Manuel Castells, writing in Communication Power, who said that this is a new form of digital time in which everything that is happening only takes place in a present, where time has no past and no future. Well, if you have no past to what you're doing, then you have no context to what you're doing. Hence, you can say, if you're Bernie Sanders, who sold out his younger generation who believed in him, that's unfortunate, but we warned you. And he will say, Saudi Arabia's our friend. Really, Bernie? And you recommend what? That they become the head of the UN Commission on Human Rights, and they're the number one abuser of human rights in the world? More beheadings, sponsoring more terrorist groups, funded the attack against 9/11, and that's okay. That's what happens when there is no history. None. But also there's no future. What is the likely outcome if we continue to defund programs to help de-ghettoize American cities, to help universal health care? What happens if we take the money from infrastructure, where we don't have any bridges, tunnels, forests being redone, as was the case in the 1930s under Franklin Roosevelt's CCC program? But you put it all into the military-industrial complex. What doesn't get eaten there gets eaten by subsidies to the banking corporations. Bail them out. Every time they fail, bail them out again. Learn nothing. You don't have to. You're not held responsible. You can lie. They're all pathological liars. Every Secretary of the Treasury, from Lawrence Summers, they all come forward and mouth things that they have to know are not true because they're not that stupid. And yet we are told by these lowlifes, our legislators, that we have to give them tens of trillions of dollars, $21 trillion. But you and I, no. If we miss a payment, we go to desert prisons. Our families are put on the street by marshals. And those marshals mean business. You laugh at them. You mock them. You do anything. You plead with them. In any way you intimidate the police today, you may find yourself on the street, beaten, tasered, or with a bullet in your head. If you're white, it's in the face. If you're black, it's in the back of the head. That's how it works. That's what happens when you create an entire training group. So it's the training, but we won't challenge the training and get people who are emotionally and psychologically unfit to serve. And we won't challenge how the people who we put into positions of authority and then ask, why did you do that? It makes no difference. We have no desire to change a system. All we can do is complain about it. And that's unfortunate. So you have no future, so you don't have to look at the consequences of what you're doing. And you have no past, you don't have to look at the context that allowed you to get to this place. So time is accelerated in this new information-saturated culture of brain-dead morons, and it also flattens out experience. So your experience in life doesn't count, your competence doesn't count, your knowledge doesn't count, and the capacity to be informed in your judgment is meaningless. You want to have someone be a good program director who has outstanding qualifications, who's run nonprofit programs and has also helped fund them, fund the stations? Great. Then why don't you hire one? Well, because they're not radically left enough? Yeah. So you want someone who's rabidly radical left because it suits your own notions of progressive ideals that have nothing to do with progressive and are warped a notion of ideals, but they're politically aligned. So you get the most incompetent people to do a job that requires competency because they're just, you'd rather choose them based upon their politics and ideology than their competence. So competence doesn't count. Experience doesn't count. Humanistic values don't count. Spiritual values don't count. Common sense doesn't count. Nothing that matter counts today in any institution. Any institution. Because we do not want a public of informed judgment. Time has thus been transformed to provide the ideological support that neoliberal values in a fast food, overprocessed temp worker economy requires to survive. So when you put out a report at the end of the month and Wall Street goes, look at that, today we'll gain another 200 points because we got an extra bunch of people working. All right. Are you giving them a living wage? Absolutely not. Are they working in a temporary season like the summer at resorts as waiters? And yes, that's right. So they're not really adding to the economy because the only thing they can add is debt because they have no savings to spend on anything. So the only time they can help the economy is when their credit card is used. So when someone creates debt in order to spur economy, is that an authentic gross domestic product economy? The answer is no. And anyone but an economic alchemist, and most of the economists in the world are alchemists, is junk science. There's no legitimacy to it. They will tell you, but the economy's doing good. By what standards? I've got 260 million Americans who are doing very bad and who are just at poverty door, whose children don't have enough to supply their nutritional needs. 28 million of them are homeless. And 106 million don't have any work, though they could work. So you exclude them completely so you can keep an artificial employment number in everyone's consciousness and no one in the media challenges. If there was any legitimacy in the integrity of a newspaper, they wouldn't publish your damn lies about a 4.8%. The actual unemployment rate in America is 27% minimum. Minimum. And the jerks on Wall Street, are there any other types? And the low-life degenerates in Washington, D.C., I'm going to make an exception. There's probably one or two that aren't. And they control the truth, and we don't challenge it anywhere. Do you think the New York Times has the capacity for any of those clowns to challenge any authority figures? Not on your life. Not in this lifetime, they won't, nor in the last. And you think alternative media is going to do it? You think someone on Pacific is going to tell you what you need to know? Well, don't hold your breath before you exhale out and see that disappointment. So all we have now is time transformed to provide the ideological support that neoliberal values require you in order you just to survive. And they'll exploit how you survive. If you're poor, they will make your poorness a crime, in which case then they will make the homeless punishable by jail time or fines it can never pay. Because someone wants to exploit it. And who allows them to do that? The legislators. And who allows the legislators to do it? The groups that give the legislators the money, the think tanks that justify it ideologically on television, those constant talking heads that you see, these are the people that you've trusted. What a mistake. All of them. Every one of them. Do you really think there is a liberal that you've ever heard on Fox? Do you think Juan Williams is a liberal? No. Not a bone in his body. Tokenism. Language has also been transformed to produce and legitimate a culture of forgetting that relishes a flight from responsibility. Capitalism, racism, consumerism, patriarchy, these are not separate. These are all commingled, feeding off each other, and are mobilized largely through a notion of common sense, which, while being contested as a site of ideological struggle, shows little sign of losing its power as a pedagogical force. As a result, we are living through an ongoing crisis of democracy. We have no democracy. It doesn't exist. You may want it to through the myth of your own complacency or stupidity, but it doesn't exist. In which both the agents and institutions necessary for such social order are being dismantled or morphed at an accelerating rate in the face of massive assault by predatory capitalism. Everything has been stolen. The curriculum has been stolen. The art of teaching has been stolen. The institutions have been compromised so that the people who benefit from education today are not the students, unless they're highly motivated, or the teachers teaching the students, but rather the people that sell the test, that create the curriculum, and the massively corrupt educational bureaucracy. So much for the unions caring about, the union leadership, I should say, caring about the ultimate goal of creating an educated, responsible, critically thinking student. That was left outside a long time ago. We live in a moment of political change in which democratic public spheres are disappearing before our eyes. Language is turned into a weapon, and ideology is transformed into an act of hate, fear, and racism and destruction, all of which is informed by a dark history of political intolerance and ethnic cleansing. The war on democracy has produced both widespread misery and suffering and finds its ideological counterpart in a culture of cruelty that has become normalized. The bankers, the hedge fund managers, the financial elite, the CEOs of the Fortune 500 company, they rule the United States. Why? Because they command the institutions, and in effect, all these major institutions have become the modern version of Mr. Kurtz and Joseph Conrad's Hearts of Darkness, who was it? Hannah Arendt said that in her Origins of Totalitarianism, these men are hollow to the core, reckless without hardihood, greedy without audacity, and cruel without courage. The only talent that could possibly burgeon in their hollow souls was the gift of fascination, which makes a splendid leader of an extreme party. Reagan, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and probably Clinton again, they all would fit perfectly in the dialogue of Mr. Kurtz and the Origins, or Conrad's Heart of Darkness. In the age of Trump and Clinton, anticipation no longer images a better world, which seems mired in a dystopian dread, mimicking the reckless chaos and uncertainty that precedes a historical moment no longer able to deal with its horrors and on the verge of a terrible catastrophe. We now live in a time in which mainstream politics sheds its ideals and falls prey to choices that resemble a stack deck of cards and mimic the values of an authoritarian society. The worse it becomes, the greater the shrill to do something. And what do? We create wars, we regime change, we create debt, massive amounts of debt. We denature the environment. We completely centralize power and control in a completely corrupt government. We should be working towards eliminating the power of our federal government and putting it into the hands of the state, where we, the people, have more influence. But we don't. Instead, we get behind people who scream, beat their chest, show us the size of their hands, as if somehow, if it only meant the size of their brains, but it doesn't. The larger the hands on these people, the smaller their brains. All they are is highly egocentric, reactive individuals. And all the while, politics is being hollowed out as a lawless and misdirected rage, while a loss of faith in electoral politics has given rise to a right-wing and left-wing populism that is more than willing to dispense with democracy itself. I had the good fortune earlier in my career to have friends who were very powerful New York Democrats. At a party they held prior to Clinton's becoming president, and it was to meet the Clintons, I had done a lot of research on the Clintons in MENA and in Arkansas and the State House, and when he was Attorney General and Governor. And I said, do you have any idea? And my host, who was my friend at that time, not now, said, look around you, Gary. All you're going to see are very successful, highly respected Democrats who look to see to the Clintons get in early, get in big, and profit 100 to 1. For every dollar they give the Clintons, they'll get $100 in return to the corporations for favored contracts. I said, I don't want to be here. I won't be here. I'm not here to argue and debate, but if I see Bill Clinton, I'm going to challenge him. And not a good idea, Gary, not a good idea. Yes, you're right, and I wouldn't do it out of just being hospitable to you, so I'll stay away. But I saw what went on. I spoke with people, and nothing has changed. What you have now is 10 to 15,000 technocrat, successful, highly educated, good pedigreed background Democrats who do not represent any liberal, humanistic principle. They represent themselves and how they can exploit it and this ever-increasing core of power is what it's about. Whether you're Democrat or Republican is irrelevant. So this demand to support Hillary Clinton as the lesser evil compared to Trump refuse to acknowledge that such mandates keep existing relations of power intact, and such actions represent more than a hollowing out of politics. They represent a refusal of the affirmative nature of political struggle. They also represent the surrender of any hope of moving beyond the enveloping fog of authoritarianism and a police state that we're now in a broken political system. Put bluntly, such choices sabotage any hope, real hope, of developing a new politics and a radical democracy. That's what Chris Hedges has been talking about. That is what all those true progressives are talking about, including Cornel West. We do have an option. Jill Stein is an option. Behind her would be Gary Johnson. Those are options. He's not perfect, but she's as close to an ideal as you could get. Why aren't Noam Chomsky and others talking about what they can do? But then again, the average American doesn't think about any of this. The people at the Republican Democratic Convention don't think about this. Why? Because they live in a manufactured ignorance. And that manufacturing ignorance provides a terrifying amount of power and infusion of money into the body politic and society, and that corrupts virtually all democratic principles and all civic life. So now what we have a combination of arrogance, power, and deceit among not just the financial elite, but virtually all the politicals. They're all a part of this. You know, what really galled me was when they were talking about how we, the Democrats, you know, we're for women and we're the ones who, you know, ended slavery. And I'm thinking, what? What? Come on, commentators, do your job. Show me you're not just a bunch of illiterate prima donnas prancing around with cosmetically enhanced and bleach blonde wigs. Show me that you actually have a brain to sit there. Whether it's Fox or MSNBC, show me. And they didn't show me anything. So, Democrats, let's take it on. You say you're responsible for helping with slavery. You caused slavery. The Democratic Party was pro-slavery. The Democratic Party was Jim Crow. Who was the most important writer of that time as a journalist? Ida B. Wells. Do you remember her? She lived not a long life. She lived about 70 years. But she was an African-American journalist. She was a suffragette. She was a feminist. She was a co-founder of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And in 1909, she was an early civil rights movement leader. She was a Republican. They were all Republicans. It was the Republicans who fought against slavery. It was the Democrats who were pro-slavery. It was the Republicans who fought against the KKK. It was the Democrats who sponsored the KKK, even allowing them in the 1920s to come tens of thousands in their capes to New York City. It was Woodrow Wilson, a massive racist, who supported the KKK. It was Ida B. Wells, who was instrumental in the anti-lynching movement, and to show it in a very realistic way of how it controlled and punished blacks who wanted to compete with whites. She actually risked her life to try to stop a lynching of a man who had been falsely accused of raping a woman. Turned out he didn't rape her. And she put herself between the man who was being lynched and the sheriff was going to lynch her. So she took pictures of it, and it was her describing how they would mutilate the body, and even after the man was dead, they'd go over and stab the man just to show symbolically they were good Democrats. And this is the truth of it. And Ida B. Wells, we should have a national monument for this woman. She's the one who took the anti-lynching movement and made it what it was to all Americans. And she would attack the KKK. She worked in the United Kingdom. She led to the Archbishop of Canterbury and members of Parliament founding the British Anti-Lynching Committee. In fact, she was a Republican. In 1894, she helped found the Republican Women's Club in Illinois to push for women's rights to vote for women to serve in office. She wasn't the only one of the African-American suffragettes who challenged the Democrats. Harriet Tubman, early abolitionist, humanitarian, who ran rescue missions to free slaves along the Underground Railroad. Sojourner Truth, the first black woman to win a civil case against a white man to get her son back from her former slave owner in 1828. Lucy Statton, first black woman to graduate college. She was a feminist. But why didn't I hear these names mentioned at the Democratic Convention? James Presley Ball, Nathaniel Booth, Peter Clark, Samuel Cornish, Ellen William Craft, Thomas Dalton, Martin Delaney, Moses Dixon, Frederick Douglass. Yeah, was Frederick Douglass a Democrat? No, he was not. He was a Republican. We've got everything turned upside down. Elizabeth Ann Garner, Henry Highland Garnett, Francis Harper, Lewis Hayden, Harriet Jacobs, Thomas James, Charles Henry Langston, John Mercer Langston, Henry Moxley, John Parker, Susan Paul, Gabriel Prosser, Harriet Purvis, Robert Purvis, Douglas Ruggles, Dred Scott. Yeah, these people made a difference. And so you fought for women's rights, did you? Were you a suffragette? No. The suffragettes were fought by the Democrats. The suffragettes were Republicans. What has happened to our country when we don't even know the basics of history? What has happened when we don't know that there were two Republican parties as spinoffs after Jefferson, and that Abraham Lincoln was the moderate Republican, but there were stronger factions? There was a faction within the Republican Party from 1854 to 1877, more radical on their anti-slavery and civil rights and voting positions than the moderate Republicans represented by Lincoln. They pushed in Congress for uncompensated abolition of slavery. Lincoln vetoed it in favor of paying owners, slave owners, for release of slaves. These people wanted to give the slaves money so they could start their life over as free individuals. Did you hear that at the convention? Ulysses S. Grant and Thaddeus Stevens were among them. So, Hillary, you care about African Americans. Why? Because Toni Morrison said, after looking at, you know, your husband and shades and playing a sax and a blue outfit like the Blues Brothers, where she called him the first black president. Fact. In 1992, when Clinton ran for president, there was still Jim Crow segregation in the South in workplaces. Blacks were still fleeing to the North and then got trapped in jobless ghettos. Although he ran on the race card by attacking Republicans for dividing the nation economically along racial lines, Bill Clinton and his wife embraced much of Reagan's agenda, doing more harm to blacks and Latinos than Reagan did. Clinton was the New Deal Democrat. He wanted to win white wealthy voters in the South, and to do that, he had to defeat the Republicans. He appointed a racially diverse cabinet, but it was only show. In point of fact, here's what came from the Clintons. The largest increase in federal and state prison inmates in history. Three-star strikes law in 1994. $30 billion crime bill that created dozens of new federal capital crimes, mandating life sentences. State prison grants were partnered with welfare monies, which then took money away from welfare recipients and gave it to the state prison system. And when Clinton left office, the U.S. had the highest incarceration rate in the world. 90% of drug offenders in prison were black. By 1996, penal budgets were twice that of food stamps. And the Clintons' welfare reform slashed funding by $54 billion. And that led to extreme poverty, doubling to 1.5 million that were hurt. Most of those were blacks. Clinton slashed public housing by 61%. They increased the prison and corrections spending by 171%. So you take away from those who need it and you give it to those who don't. They eliminated the Pell Education grants for prisoners. They signed legislation that imposed lifetime bans on welfare and food stamps for anyone convicted of a felony drug offense. And yet they still lie. Hillary, easy to discredit you on so many counts, but you tried to credit your husband with a low joblessness when he left office. Fact. When Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton left office, the jobless rate for black men was 42%. Isn't it time that we took to the truth? You support NATO. Why? NATO's a criminal organization, has been responsible for the destruction of Libya. You created the destruction of Libya. It was you, the super hawk, the person who has now said that you're for using nuclear weapons. You're for bombing Iran and Russia and China. You believe that we should have massive military fleets around these countries to provoke them. What exactly did China and Russia and Iran do to the United States to deserve this? You're recreating a new Cold War that hasn't existed in 25 years because your contractors, the people on Wall Street, the munitions makers, the big military industrial, they make billions of dollars when we fear something and you create the fear. This is a fact. I'll save the audio clips for tomorrow. Today, it is not Democrats or Republicans that support minorities or the poor. They both profit by exploiting you. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party are both racist. They are both anti-humanistic. They are both equally guilty. They just have different ways of manifesting. If you put money into a wall on the border and you put money that they don't even need into military-industrial complex and you take money from where it is needed, then you have done no one a service. When you profile people of color for stop and search, when you allow for asset forfeiture of over $4 billion a year where no one was arrested, no one was cited, no tickets given, you simply stole the car or stole the cash that the person had in the car as if you had a right to do it. And not a word about asset forfeiture, not a word about spying on every single American, not a word about all the illegalities of the National Security Agency and the CIA, not a word about regime change, not a word about how you have caused the death of over 1.5 million Americans and your husband caused the death of 500,000 children, and you still have Madeleine Albright as one of your primary people that you support? And this doesn't make the news? I'll complete it with this. This is from Global Research. Libya, quote, from Africa's wealthiest democracy under Gaddafi to U.S. NATO-sponsored terrorist haven. On October 20th, it marks the fourth year anniversary of the U.S.-backed assassination, of Libya's former leader, Gaddafi, and the decline into chaos of Africa's greatest nation. In 1967, Colonel Gaddafi inherited one of the poorest nations in Africa. By the time he was assassinated, he had transformed Libya into Africa's richest nation, best healthcare system, best education system, most rights for women, and wealthiest individuals. As individuals, not a hierarchy. Prior to the U.S.-led bombing campaign in 2011, Libya had the highest human development index and the lowest infant mortality rate and the highest life expectancy of all 54 countries in Africa. Today, Libya is a failed state. Western military intervention has caused all the worst scenarios. Western embassies have been left. The south of the country has become a haven for ISIS terrorists. The northern coast, a center of migrant trafficking. Egypt, Algeria, and Tunisia have closed their borders with Libya. This all occurs amidst a backdrop of widespread rape, assassinations, and torture that complete the picture of a state that has failed to the bone. Libya currently has two competing governments, two parliaments, two sets of rivalry claims to control the central bank and the oil. And yet, we supported all this. And by the way, for those who said, yeah, but Libya was run by a tyrant, you're wrong. Far from control being in the hands of one man, Libya was highly decentralized and divided into several small communities that were essentially mini autonomous states. So within a state, you had multiple jurisdictions of the people. These autonomous states had control over their districts and could make and arrange a decision in anything they wanted, how to allocate oil revenue and budgetary funds. And within these many autonomous states, the three main bodies of Libya's democracy were the local communities, the Basic People's Congress, and the Executive Revolutionary Councils. The Basic People's Congress was essentially Libya's functional equivalent of the House of Commons in the United Kingdom, or the House of Representatives of the United States. And these were not based upon rich elected individuals. Everyone had an opportunity to participate. The Congress allowed all Libyans to directly participate in the process. 800 People's Congresses were set up across the country, and every single Libyan was free to attend and shape national policy and make decisions over all major issues, including budgets, education, industry, and the economy. In 2009, the New York Times was invited by Gaddafi to Libya to spend 2 weeks observing the nation's direct democracy. The New York Times, that has traditionally been critical of Gaddafi, said the following, quote, this in the New York Times, everyone is involved in every decision. Tens of thousands of people take part in local committee meetings to discuss issues and vote on everything from foreign treaties to building schools, end quote. That's the New York Times. The fundamental difference between Western democratic systems and Libyan's direct democracy is that in Libya, all citizens were allowed to voice their views directly, not in one parliament of only 100 wealthy politicians, but in hundreds of committees attended by tens of thousands of ordinary citizens. Far from being a military dictatorship, Libya under Gaddafi was Africa's most prosperous democracy. On numerous occasions, Gaddafi's personal proposals were rejected by popular vote during Congresses, and the opposite of his desire was implemented. For example, on many occasions, Gaddafi proposed to abolish capital punishment. He didn't believe in the death penalty. And he pushed for homeschooling over traditional schools. The People's Congress wanted to maintain the death penalty in classic schools, and that's what became the law. He was overridden. For four decades, Gaddafi promoted economic democracy and used the nationalized oil wealth to sustain progressive social welfare programs for all Libyans. And under Gaddafi's rule, Libyans enjoyed not only free health care and free education and free electricity and interest-free loans. No thanks to NATO's intervention, the health care sector is on the verge of collapse now. But unlike the West, Libyans do not vote once every 4 years for a president and an invariably wealthy local parliamentarian who would then make all their decisions. Ordinary Libyans made decisions regarding foreign, domestic, and economic policy daily. Daily. But all that ended because of one person and one person only, Hillary Clinton, and all those innocent civilians dead and all those infrastructures destroyed. And now a hotbed of terrorism, breeding ground. And yet, Bernie knew all this, and he chose not to challenge it. Well, hopefully Jill Stein will. She is the last hope, her and behind her, Gary Johnson. Remember, 21% of registered voters are Republican, about 26-28% are Democrat, but over 41% are independent. Those who do not believe in independent vote matters do not understand how powerful the independents are. They need unity, and now they can get behind the other two candidates. And just be aware of what you're getting when you vote for Clinton. All you have to do is look at history, look at the lies. And today, both parties, Republican and Democrat, are nothing but a house of pathological, manipulative, liar neocons. So it doesn't matter whether they call themselves Democrat or Republican. But there was a time in America where being a good Democrat meant that you supported the KKK, you supported slavery. In fact, they didn't want the Second Amendment because they were afraid of blacks getting guns. Gee whiz. Wonder how that would work today if every black in America had a gun, because you couldn't own a gun back then. And so those who could do harm did, and there was no recourse for what you did to a black. Those were the good Democrats. Who fought them? The good Republicans. At least know your history. And unfortunately today, we're culturally ignorant of all this. But today there is no good Republican and good Democrat. They're both bad to the bone. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.